I'm here in Trinidad with Richard Black, who was born on the 7th February 1954 in St. Lucia and travelled to the UK at the age of 6 in 1960. Richard, it's a pleasure to have you here today.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here with you as well.
Please, let's start by you telling us your story. How did you come to travel to the UK?
A few years prior, my eldest brother, and my mother had migrated to the UK somewhere in the late 50s. After a few years, when they got together financially, they were able to send for me. So I was able to travel to the UK. In those days, we traveled via boat. We arrived. I was put in the care of a lady who was caretaker, my caretaker. We arrived. I can remember arriving in I think it was November of 1960.
Did you travel on your own?
No, I was there. I had somebody who was traveling to the UK as well, so my mother put me in her care.
Okay, and right. How did your mother purchase your ticket?
To be honest, I can't remember how it was done. If it was my brother, it would have been more than likely my brother would have done that, right?
And what do you remember about the journey? Do you remember packing your suitcase and arriving at the ship?
I was totally, I had one little cardboard suitcase. In those days, suitcases were made of cardboard. Right, they used to call them cockroach dens. Right, I remember that. So I was put in the care of this lady, who looked after me the best she could. Right, I guess I was a miserable youngster at the time. I can remember arriving in a Bermuda shirt in the UK and a short pants. Right. In the middle of winter, it was when I got outside. I think it was the worst winter ever.
Did somebody come to collect you?
Yes, when we arrived at Paddington Station, from the docks where the ship docked, my brother and my mother met me at the stations, and they carried me to Paddington. That's where they were living at the time, Paddington.
How long had it been since you'd seen your family at that point?
Oh, it would have been about 5-6 years, probably. Yeah, 5-6 years.
So your mother left for England when
I was a baby. Yeah, with my grandmother at the time, yeah.
Yeah, so can you remember seeing her then for the first time?
Well, I was confused because I was seeing basically a stranger, right? And my caretaker who escorted me to the UK. Right, I said, look, here's your mum. So I was glad the journey was over. Right, it was a horrendous journey.
Okay, so you're 6 years old, you arrive in winter. Mm-hmm. Do you remember starting school?
I remember going to Essendine Primary School.
Where was that?
When?
Where was that?
That's in Paddington as well.
Okay.
That's in Paddington as well. I think school is still in existence. I checked on them recently. They're still in existence. I went there. When I arrived in the UK, I was hardly literate, right? I could hardly read. I took an interest in chess. For some reason, you don't have to be able to read in the early stages of playing chess, but just understand the concept. And I excelled in that. And that was the motivation for me to learn to read. Right, so that is so. I went through the primary system, and then from there I went to Cardinal Hensley, which is in Harlesden. Right, I think they've changed their name now. I think they're Newman College now. They call it the Newman College in Harlesden, and from there my education picked up a bit. I met this teacher who was originally from India, right, and she was very focused in terms of getting me to pick up speed, so to speak, right, and from there I didn't do that well in school, to be honest, and From there, I went to Paddington Tech to do photography.
Okay.
I did photography there. I worked with a few labs in the UK. Trying to remember the name now. Simon Bell and Associates. That was a dye transfer. That was just off the Edgware Road. And then I worked for Studio 10. They were in the City of London. And then there was another Photoshop, and they were, I can't remember where they were right now, but yeah, so I worked in the UK, I worked for a number of years, and then I met then Salian Wells, who was my first wife, right, and we got married. I was 24 at the time. Mm-hmm. Got married, a civil marriage at the Kensington Chelsea registry office, right? We were married for 18 years. We had two children together, two daughters. Tanya Arias, who was born in the UK, right? She now resides in St. Martin, and she has her own family. And then Marissa, also my daughters, right, who has her own story to tell. So I'll probably introduce you at some other point to tell for her as well.
Okay, so you're working and living in London. You're
yes.
a young man. You've
mm-hmm.
just got married.
Mm-hmm.
At what point then did you leave the UK?
Right,
and how did that come to be?
All right, when I got married, none of my in-laws were in the UK. My in-laws were in Trinidad. So in 1978, my wife suggested that. She was studying accountancy in the UK. She said, well, she wants to go home and introduce me to her family, you know.
Mm.
Right, that was in 78. So we came down in 1978 on vacation, right. I met my then-in-laws. We were introduced something like that, and then we stayed for Carnival, because, you know, you can't come to Trinidad and don't experience Carnival, so we stayed for Carnival.
Yeah. And can you remember how many months you stayed for?
We came in December, and we returned in March of 79.
Okay. And what were your impressions of Trinidad?
Well, Japan was this party kingdom. At that time, I was really into, you know, parties and things like that, and you're there for Carnival. I said, well, this place is great. This place is off the grid, so to speak. So it was a real fun experience. And then we returned to the UK.
So that was on the 8th of March in 1979.
Yes, I want to believe that's when we returned.
And what was that journey like? What can you remember?
In terms of coming or returning?
Did you travel by
We flew. We traveled by at that time it was BWIA, British West Indian Airways, and then we came back via the same route as well.
So you left Port of Spain and you arrived at. Can you remember what airport you arrived at?
I think it had been Heathrow.
Okay.
Been Heathrow, yeah.
And can you remember anything about your interactions with the immigration officer?
Well,
when I
returned, right, and I handed my passport to the immigration person, right? I did not, and I can't remember if they kept it for any length of time. That's some 40 plus years ago. But I didn't check when I got my passport. I didn't even bother checking it, because as far as I'm concerned, I was back home.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no reason for me to really, you know, question or even look into the passport.
So the passport you used
was a British passport.
Holiday,
was a British passport.
Had you acquired it while you were living in the UK?
Correct. Yes.
And what process then did you go through to?
Well, when I arrived in the UK, I had the old British colonial passport. It was still a British passport.
Which was in 1960.
Yes. All right. So I had that passport, and when that expired, then I applied for a British passport, and there was no problem getting my British passport.
Mm-hmm. And your passport initially was from St. Lucia?
The first one, yes, yes, yes.
Okay, so you had a St. Lucian colonial passport.
Yes, and we used that to travel to the UK in the first instance.
And then you arrived, and then obviously you spent time in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
Was Trinidad the first time that you left the UK then?
Yes, it was, yes.
And
yes.
Can you remember anything about how you acquired your passport?
Well, I think it was in either in July or when my wife, well, my passport had expired, the one I traveled as a kid.
Yeah.
Right, so my wife said, well, you need to have you renew your passport. It was a simple process. I mean, I can't remember the process in detail now, but there was no problem in terms of me getting a British passport. Right, and
so this wasn't a UK colony passport.
It's a full British passport
in the UK, and you travelled on this. Mm-hmm. But upon return, what happened when you arrived?
Well, when I arrived at the airport, it was obvious it was stamped subject to immigration control. That I did not become aware of that until much later. Because really, I wasn't really, because you basically return home, you hand your passport to the immigration people, they stamp it, and you go about your business, right? And I was naive at the time.
In what sense?
Well, did not understand the complexities of British immigration laws, mm-hmm. or how it impact on me as an individual.
But also because you had a British passport and you were told that you're a British citizen and you were arriving in the UK as British with documentation
to prove at the time that I was British. Right.
So then what happened next?
Well, nothing really, because in terms of the immigration aspect of it, because the passport was taken, placed away in a drawer somewhere accessible. It was not until my in-laws, right, fell ill, and then there were issues with my wife wanting to come back home and look after. I said, let's go for a couple of months, right? Because and basically she wanted to be there for her parents, and I wasn't going to fight that because she'd just given birth a couple of years prior, right, to my eldest daughter. Well,
okay.
Second eldest daughter.
So do you return to Trinidad then?
Yeah, we come on an extended vacation.
And what year was that?
That was in 1983, December of 1983.
Okay. And what happened during that trip?
Well, nothing, because the passport was still viable. It wasn't did not expire, so I could travel with it.
And how long did you stay in Trinidad?
We stayed for a few years because I was unemployed in the UK. I just lost my job, right? Company was downsizing, so it wasn't a problem for me to come and to spend some time with my wife's with my in-laws. It was not a problem for me because I'd met them a few years before, and I found them to be very nice and they treated me well, so it wasn't a problem.
Yeah.
Right, my wife's father was very sick, right, he subsequently passed away, and then her mother subsequently passed away as well.
Okay, right. So you spent a few years in Trinidad, mm-hmm. with your wife, with her family.
Mm-hmm.
When do you realise that there's an issue?
When the passport has expired now, so I need to go to the British High Commission, right, and have it, and speak to somebody there. And then it all becomes clear to me, because then they explain to me, right, I am no longer British. St. Lucia gained independence in 1917, I think it was March of 1979.
It was February 22nd,
1979.
Yeah.
Right, they got independence. So now I'm told, in those days the British High Commission wasn't in St. Clair, it was down Independence Square, right, and I'm told now that, wait, you're no longer British.
And can you remember what year they told you that? So you went on holiday to Trinidad in 1983?
Yeah. I can't remember the exact year, but that would have been just before or just around the park. I travelled with the passport to the States, right, to meet my other in-laws. So when it, I would always get a date for you when that is happening, right? But When that happened, I can remember going to the British High Commission and being told that I'm no longer British.
And can you remember who you saw? Was it a receptionist? Did someone come down and speak to
Somebody
you?
Came down.
Do you know who it was?
I can't remember the person's name. You know, Sam?
What did they say to you specifically?
Well, St. Lucia basically gained independence in 1979,
mm-hmm.
right, the 22nd of February. And as a result, I needed to get a St. Lucian passport or a Trinidad and Tobago passport.
Yeah, and Trinidad became independent on the 31st of August 1960. two, so that was already independent.
Yeah, but there was no way, right, I could become, get Trinidad Tobago passport.
Mm-hmm.
St. Lucia has no high commission or any body in Trinidad that I could speak with.
So did you try and contact them, the St. Lucian High Commission?
I was stunned. I was emotionally, I was a wreck. I could remember and saying to her, what am I going to do now? Right? And I could remember the guy said, well, you know, or you get in touch with St. Lucia. I didn't even have the slightest idea. And I want to say this, and I'm not ashamed of saying it, right? Intellectually, not mature. I was just forgive me if I get emotional because I'm starting to remember the negatives, right? And I was a wreck. I didn't know what to do. I was 29 at the time, right?
Did you share this story with anybody? So this was we were in the mid-80s, basically.
Yeah, and I talked to my wife.
She was in Trinidad,
right? And I'm saying, this is what people are saying. So she said, well, you need to go back and see if you talk to somebody else, right? So I went back, right, after a couple of weeks. I swallowed my pride, went back, because I was treated like, you know, dog mess, right? And I could see the smoke. I didn't know what it was at the time, but now I can relate. I'm a lot brighter now, a lot smarter now, right? So I can relate to people's look, how they look at you, right?
Mm.
And I'm saying this person telling me, well, it hasn't changed. You still have to get in touch with St. Lucian people, and they will get you a passport. You're not British, right? You're not British, and it was said in such a way that I understood it, not because I was smarter, because of the hurt I felt at the time.
And by telling you that your UK documentation is no longer valid, mm-hmm. and by telling you that by having no way of accessing mm-hmm. the St. Lucian authorities, you're effectively left stateless.
Correct. And what they said to me, and I can remember saying this, right? Well, I will have to get a job. That's what I told the guy. Because I have children. I have a daughter, right? And whilst I was working in the UK, whatever monies I made, right, went to my family. Now I'm here, right? The good thing was that my in-laws at the time had a small estate in the south, right? So when I was there, I was basically helping them, right, while they were sick. No, there was no money. They didn't pay me. I stayed free and ate free, and
right.
my family.
How many times did you then approach the British High Commission during this
About
time period?
Three times. The last time I approached them, after they told me what it did, I didn't want to go back at all. Right? I didn't want to go back at all because they embarrassed me, and I felt real shitty, right? For want of a better term, right? But when I learned that my mom died in 2000, and by that time my relationship with my wife had expired.
And was your wife still in Trinidad, or had she?
Yeah, she's still in Trinidad. Yeah. Right. My relationship, because I mean, you know.
Were you able to register with the Trinidadian authorities?
Yes, I was. When we realized that, I was able to get paperwork, so I got residency. So I wasn't going to be kicked out.
Did you use your expired British passport then to get residency as a form of documentation?
It was had not expired yet, but what she said, right, we'll be coming and going, right? My wife was a lot smarter than me, right? So she said, we'll be coming and going, so let us apply for this thing in case, you know, we decide to at some point in the future come back to Trinidad and stay for longer, so we'll have no problems.
So how long were you in Trinidad then, in total?
Well, once I realized that I couldn't, because I was traveling backwards and forwards, right before the passport expired.
Between where, sorry?
Went to the States.
The
we met with my in-laws in Philadelphia, right? And so we had a good relationship. But when everything went south, so to speak, right? I really felt, well, look, I was living with in St. James, which isn't too far from here. And my in-laws, and then they asked me to, well, look, you have to leave. My wife then went back to the UK. She got British status. Right now my wife is a citizen of the UK. They're saying that she could get my ex-wife. So is this one by the this one has more rights in the UK than me, right? So she's basically, so I'm stuck. I became homeless, right? For 4 years, I was basically a vagrant, right? I lived in empty lots, right? I got chased away a lot. I got shot at. I got if it wasn't a gun, it was a stones by a catapult. And wait not for the blessings and kindness of some many Trinidadians. Right, I might have died all now. I might have, you know, not been around. But I met some good people. They were able to help me re-educate myself, help me get jobs on construction sites. Right, so I was able to do that. And then I realized, then it was an epiphany. You need to be smarter. You need to re-educate yourself. You need to do something to uplift yourself, right? And I started to work for a company, a construction company in Trinidad and Tobago. And they were basically doing construction work in the oil and gas and downstream industries. And I was lucky to get through that. And then I did some more training, and I became a health and safety advisor. And you know the funny thing, the first major job I got working in the oil and gas field was for BPTT. How ironic is that? You understand?
Yes. And were you working with British employers as well?
I was working with BP, and they're just from the Savannah. They had offices just from the Savannah, right? And I was in charge of two fabricators. Imagine that. I was in charge of two fabrication yards, right? And I was their offshore and onshore health and safety advisor. And so it was like a bitter bit. And I was thinking all the time, how do I screw these people? What can I do to take revenge for what they did to me? But I didn't do that. I just did my job, got paid for what I did, and that was it.
What about your family in the UK? How did you communicate with them at that time, and did you try and tell them what?
Well,
my
mum was still alive, and she couldn't understand, because my mother wasn't all that literate. She couldn't understand how everybody could go and come back, and I couldn't come back. Yes, and she probably felt at the time that I was probably playing games, right? But you know, I just couldn't come back. I could not.
Did you ever try and board a plane or buy a plane ticket?
How would I do that? I had no means of I couldn't do that, because I had no documentation that would allow me to do that, right? Because the passport, and they took the passport.
They confiscated.
Yeah, the passport is
illegal. The High Commission.
Yeah.
So how did that come to be? Did you?
Well, I naively gave them the passport, because at that time, you're told that everything British is right. It's only now that you know that people in Gaza left down the lurch because of British complicity, right? Of a deal gone bad. They basically stole Arab land and gave it to Israelites. Yeah, so I'm saying. So now we're learning how complicated British and how deceitful the British government could be.
And were you told by any staff at the High Commission that they would help you, or that, or were
one, I think, you were, I think, I, what, I think, what, somebody said to me, if memory serves me right, because it's on their records, and I want to believe that conversation. I don't want to misrepresent any situation. I believe that conversation where they said to me they could get me a returning resident visa. They said they gave me the visa, which is a total fabrication that I never received. Nobody made contact with me concerning that. If you don't make contact with me.
But right. how can you have a returning resident visa if you don't have a passport to put it in?
Well, you see, that was the thing as well, because you must have a passport to put that in, right? And they said that, apparently, when I had an interview with what a guy named, some guy called me when this whole Windrush thing affair broke, and said to me that a returning resident visa was offered to me, but I could. They made no effort. They could not have made contact with me because I was on the streets, right?
So. But at that point, they saw you as a resident, not as a citizen, which is the essential difference.
Yes.
You were being reclassified as a non-Briton, basically.
Exactly.
The expectation then was for you to get a St. Lucian passport, to which you were entitled, to then be able to obtain a returning residence visa, which was impossible to you at the time because you didn't have any of those documents.
No.
Correct. Okay, so when did things start to shift? When did things start to change?
Well, when my daughter, Marissa, notified me that there was a huge scandal in terms of people that were British were being denied their rights as being British, right? And they were being denied re-entry. So I made contact with I wrote a letter to the passport office in the UK, gave them my particulars, right? And I got a response back after a couple of weeks, and basically saying that the situation hasn't changed, I'm not British, right? Blah, 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 blah. And I'll send a copy of that letter for you. I think I still have that letter. I'll send a copy of that for you. Right.
And so your daughter Marissa, where was she living at this?
In Trinidad. She was born in Trinidad.
And where did she hear the news then about what was happening?
Marissa had news is another. She's always on the internet, on would hear stuff from friends. Because we were not aware of anything going on. Because I'd basically say, well, it is what it is. I'm in Trinidad, and at some point in time I'll apply for Trinidad's citizenship because I've been here long enough.
Were you aware that there were other people who had been experiencing the same issues as you?
No,
had you ever met anybody else who was?
Not at the time, no one in 2018, no.
Mm-mm. So how did that make you feel, knowing that this was not just an issue that was affecting you as an individual, but was a much bigger...
Well, when I realised that, I said, well, this is some kind of a plot by the government to get rid of black people from the UK, and to me it's a racist... It's a racist situation. So I joined Twitter at the time, and started to get talked to a few people, talked to Ewan Herbert. I don't know if you heard of Ewan Herbert. Yes, right. Talked to me, and he told me what was happening in terms of his experiences. Talked to Jackie McKenzie as well in the earliest as well.
So can you just explain who Jackie McKenzie is, please?
Jackie McKenzie, she's my attorney. She's a lawyer who's handling the immigration cases for a lot of Windrush people, right?
And how did you get in contact with her?
Well, I've known Jackie, been aware of Jackie since 2018, right? Last year, I wrote to her, and she responded, and she said that she would take up my case, and she's been dealing with my case ever since.
Okay, so how, in what way then did Jackie start to help you in a legal sense?
Well, basically she's, in terms of the compensation, she's handling the compensation aspect of it for me.
But initially upon learning about your case, what was her
Well, she felt, well, I was just part and parcel of the whole conspiracy, right? I was a victim of the conspiracy. And she felt that I had a strong case, right? And she's fighting my case. in terms of getting proper compensation. Yeah. She's handling my compensation aspect of it.
And so how did that progress? So in 2018, then you contacted Jackie McKenzie, your daughter was helping you.
Yeah, and then I went ballistic. I had a better understanding of what was taking place, right? I was on Twitter a lot, explaining my situation, meeting people who were in similar positions in the UK and who were also left stranded abroad because they were classified as no longer being British, right? So it started then, and I was... There's one of my pictures from... And then I had interviews...
Yeah, so we're looking here at the interview you did in The Independent with
Nathan White.
And that was on the 29th of April 2021.
Right.
And the headline on that is Windrush scandal victim Richard Black to return to the UK after the...
But there's an earlier interview where it was Sky News. Sky News came down and they interviewed me home.
Yeah, and I believe that Channel 4 spoke with you as well.
Yes, yes. And Channel 4, Sarah, what's her name again? I think. She did an interview at home as well.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that's Sam, I think. Okay, so there was a lot of interest, basically. Suddenly a flurry of interest in your specific case.
Yes.
How did that make you feel?
Well, at first, right, it was fun, but when I realized that it was to talk about myself and to share the story, similar people were, as a result of the situation, people were experiencing, I thought, you know, I survived the hardship that I went through in Trinidad. I survived. And my situation was much better than a lot of other people who were less fortunate than me, who did not meet the people that were pivotal in my change.
And since then, have you met any other people in Trinidad who have had similar experiences?
No, sad, funny enough, no. I don't think Trinidadians are such. There are a few, but I don't think there are many. Like, for example, the other territories like Jamaica and St. Lucia to an extent, right? But I felt, you know, I made my peace with God. I accepted the Muslim faith, and I tried to progress from where I was, right, to try and elevate myself, both mentally and physically. I've suffered a lot of...
And spiritually.
And I am comfortable in terms of where we are now, in terms of that. So when they denied me re-entry, I basically said, well, okay, you guys stay there, I'm in the sun, I'm not going to freeze. Right.
So you decided not to travel to the UK?
Yeah, I decided, well, you know, they didn't give me, I had no options, I had no passport, no nothing. I only got a St. Lucia passport last week.
Right, and how did that process come to be? So how did you come to get your St. Lucia passport?
That in itself is just as complicated. It's taken a year and change to get a St. Lucia passport. First of all, I had to make contact. We have some friends who had some St. Lucia contacts. And when I explained to them the situation, considering that the British wanted me to get a St. Lucia passport to be able to travel, they were able to put me for a lady in St. Lucia who's a justice of the peace. And I explained to her my position, right, and she said that she would assist. At a cost, obviously, and because it's a business, right? So we ended up saving some money, and we're able to via MoneyGram send money, and then she started digging up. She got my birth certificate. She was able to get a copy of my St. Lucia birth certificate. Mm. And then she got in touch with a local law firm in St. Lucia, right? And I was able to, because I changed my name from Paul Marius to Richard Sheldon Black, right? And I just felt that, you know, the horrific circumstances that I had experienced earlier on, I just needed to do a reboot, as it were, all right? A makeover. So I changed my name to Richard Sheldon Black, right, from Paul Marius. Apparently, very importantly, right, my mother, I was illegitimate, right, so I should have obviously had my mother's surname, but that didn't transpire. It was on my birth certificate, because my mother's surname was Daniel, so I was Leo Marius on my birth certificate, so that was what went about. So I called myself Paul Leo Marius, right? So they picked up on that in St. Lucia, said, no, you should have been given your mother's maiden name, which was Daniel, right? So then I had to redo another deed poll. How many deed polls did we have to do? About three deed polls, and send it over. Then we went through the High Commission, St. Lucian High Commission in the UK, right?
Which High Commission?
St. Lucian High Commission.
In the UK.
So
who went there physically?
Right. She was my wife.
Yeah.
Present wife went to the UK with the documents and passport size pictures, right? And they applied for a passport for me since what? Since 2021? Eh? Right? I've been waiting for this passport, which only arrived last week.
Mm. And but you achieved it.
I achieved it since
being told in the 1980s
that
you were St. Lucian and not British.
Right. I have no problems with being a St. Lucian, by the way. Yeah.
Did you feel anything when you finally got the passport?
I cried.
Yeah.
I was in tears. Because I... this lady witnessed it. I just broke down. It just meant that I was no longer trapped. You understand? And I could travel. All right. And one of the things I used to say a lot and things like this, when I was in the UK, I traveled. When I had passport, I traveled. So I made excuses for not wanting to travel.
Did you ever try? And register as a stateless person and declare yourself stateless?
I didn't have no knowledge of these things, honestly. Although one of the subjects that I took to help re-educate myself was A-level law, right? Self-taught as well, A-level law. Now I got a credible pass, I got a C in A-level law. And so I started to look at things. I started to read up on where I could on British immigration law.
Mm.
But I'm no lawyer.
Okay, your story is such an important one, for not just for this project, but for everybody really to hear. And I'm really appreciative that you've taken the time to share your experiences with me today. I've got an impact statement here you provided.
Yes.
And a huge part of this, it's not just detailing what you can remember in terms of dates, your interactions with the British High Commission in Trinidad, and your efforts really in trying to sort the situation out.
Mm-hmm.
But also there's a very large component of this, which is about the emotional impact on you. And now, I've no wish or desire for us to relive any of this trauma, so we don't have to talk about this today. But what really struck me from your impact statement, which is very powerful, were, for example, the impact that it had on your mental health and the impact that it had on your physical health as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of you made a very strong case that because you didn't have access to the UK healthcare system, you've experienced many health issues because you were essentially blocked in something that was your right as a citizen to access. So I think that's it's a very, very powerful document and text to read about everything that you've been put through.
You know, one of the things I learned from this, right, that people could be homeless but still have compassion for other homeless people. And were it not for some people who I met, right, transients like myself, who, when I tried to kill myself, right, they would say, no, something will happen tomorrow, something will happen later, right, let me hold on now, boy, hold on, let me try and thing, and they would be, they say, Englishman, you want to kill yourself, and don't be so and so stupid, you know what I'm saying, right? This is happening.
And so what did come about was the Windrush compensation scheme, right? It was an opportunity then for you to have this trauma and this mistreatment recognised officially by the British state. What was your experience of the compensation scheme itself?
They insulted. They offered me some, what was it? I can't remember. 30,000 or 40,000? 40,000. Well,
in total?
Yeah, in total.
And did you accept the money?
No.
Why?
Because my anguish and my pain over those years, right? I mean, my wife, my first wife and I, we separated. But that was as a result, because we had a good thing going then. That was as a result of distress and frustration that was being felt. And I had I was in such a state that if it was me, I would have divorced me. If you understand what I'm saying, right? And today we are good friends. Today we are very good friends, and she's very good friends with my wife, current wife, and things like that. So that part of my life has been healed, right? But what really, Eve, that really irks and hurts me to this day and will always think was when I learned that my mother was sick in 2003, and I went back and I begged these people, I pleaded with them, I told them that my mom was sick, right, and the prognosis wasn't good. They had no compassion. It was still...
Do you remember who used?
No, I can't remember. I didn't take their names.
You went to the British
Icon. Yeah, right, and I talked to somebody and things like that, and I said, I need to get back, please allow me to come back. Right, because my mom and things like that. And then I went back. It was when I learned she was sick, and when I learned that she passed away in August 12th, when my mom passed away, I went back in tears, crying, and I asked them people and things like that. And I left the British High Commission in tears, right, and I was lost, and I will never forgive them for that. I cannot forgive them for that. Right? And all the hurt and trauma that I've experienced, the most hurtful part of it was not being able there to say goodbye or be there for my mom when she was ailing and when she passed. And there's no, I'm a Muslim, but I will ask my God not to allow, not there must never be forgiveness for that. Because everybody has a mother. Everybody has, some people may not get along with their mom, but you just cannot treat people like that. I was never involved in any criminality or anything when I was in the UK.
And did they ever try and reach out to you at any point beyond you physically going to the commission and asking for help?
When I start to send letters to the Windrush thing, that they had somebody, a gentleman came on,
sorry, it came on the computer.
From the Home Office, right?
Okay. Was it in person or was it on
No, that was on a phone call. And she was basically telling me what to do. And she was Home Office. Mm-hmm. And she was telling me to write letters. And she was very good. She told me to come to the British High Commission. And I was reluctant to do that. And I told her, no, the experiences I've had there, I'm not going to be embarrassed again. She convinced me that to meet a local, right, at the British High Commission.
Who did you meet
her? I can't remember her name. Right, but I met with her. And she had an interview, and then she had my biometrics taken in 2018.
Yeah.
In 2018, I had the biometrics done. All right. How I remember that, because they just remind me, the Home Office reminded me of when I had it done. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
In March,
they were able to give me a date as well. Somewhere in March of 2018, I had my biometrics done. And then it evolved from there. I was able to... I talked to them. I kind of roughed them up as well online when I had the opportunity, right? Told them they were a pack of... I don't really want to use any obscene language, but I told them exactly what I thought of it, right? I called all the... what was the guy? Savage Javid was the first one, and then Priti Patel, and then this... I don't want to be very, she's a female, so I don't want to be too harsh on her, right? But there's something, I mean, I may have my mental issues, right? But I think there's something wrong with that lady, seriously wrong with her, right? She's not real.
What about the response that you got from the Windrush Help team then? Did you speak to them over the phone?
Over the phone.
How did you find them? How did they treat you?
Well, to be honest, I've had some issues with some of the people that I have dealt with. But this current individual that I'm speaking with, she's showing a lot of humanity and concern. And some of the stuff that she, if you read some of the stuff that she was happy when I got the passport. And very early on, she told me that I am a person that should not have been in this position. She didn't come out and say it like that.
Yeah.
But she understand I felt I'm a victim. She said I'm a victim of the bureaucracy. And I understand what she means by that, right?
And I have here a letter then that I imagine this is the latest correspondence you received from them, which was the 19th of May, 2023.
Mm-hmm.
And in the letter, they confirm then that the Home Office will provide support to you so that you and your wife can return to the United Kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
And what they're proposing... first of all, they're saying it won't be deducted from the compensation award that you've been offered, and that in addition to the compensation award, you will be provided with flights, airport transfer, accommodation for up to 4 weeks in the UK.
In the first instance.
In rental, either in a hotel or in an Airbnb accommodation.
Mm-hmm.
So they'll provide you with daily living costs during a settling-in period.
Mm-hmm.
And then help you with clothing, suitcases, and medication. And it says this assistance is being provided to you under the urgent and exceptional payment policy, and the typical amount for these payments is normally less than £5,000. However, this is considered on a case-by-case basis. It also says once you've received your passport, please let us know your intended travel date as soon as possible. So first, have you received a British passport?
My St. Lucian passport.
Your St. Lucian passport.
I have, yeah.
So they'll so you're receiving a St. Lucian passport, and on that St. Lucian passport, they're going to put a returning resident visa.
Which they're in the process of doing right now.
So through the Windrush compensation scheme, despite being told that you were a victim of bureaucracy, despite acknowledgement from the Home Office that you were appallingly treated, in fact. And despite being offered the means to return to the UK and resettle in the UK, you're still not being offered a UK passport.
Well, let me explain to you what happens there now. And this is how they're smart. When I could get a British passport through the Windrush scheme, but it comes as if you like. If you're no longer a citizen, but you get it through naturalization. So if you're a naturalized citizen, my concern would be, am I less than an actual
So effectively, you would enter the UK as a Saint Lucian.
Mm-hmm.
You would be given residency in the UK, mm-hmm. and then after the specified time period, you would be given the opportunity to naturalise.
No, there's no time period.
Okay.
I could, as I get back.
Oh, you could do that.
I could do that immediately.
So you would naturalise as a citizen. You wouldn't be recognised as British.
Yes. So that
is a two-tier level.
It's a two-tier level. So that is a trick. But I am, like I said,
And there's a belief that they extended the courtesy to your wife as well. Is that
yes,
correct?
Yes, she's received a residency.
Your children,
no. One of them was born in the UK, and the other one was not born in the UK.
What year was your child born in the UK?
79.
Okay, so yeah,
that was
you have
September.
One, so you have one child who is British. Effectively, yeah.
Yes.
And one child who is not recognised. So, where is this going now then? Are you planning to return to the UK? Are you going to accept?
Yes, well, yes, we are returning. The tentative return date would be April. We plan to leave Trinidad on April the 14th. Which is a Sunday.
It's 2024.
2024,
okay.
And arrive in the UK Monday the 15th of April 2024.
And have the Home Office already purchased your tickets for you, your flight?
They're basically waiting for me to get the returning resident stamp in my passport, which they have currently. Right.
So who has your St. Lucian passport right now?
That's the Visa Application Centre. They're in Woodbrook, number one Woodbrook place. They handle all British visa applications.
Okay, let me just understand this, see if I've understood this clearly. So you acquired your St. Lucian passport in Trinidad.
Yes.
And your St. Lucian passport, did you post that? Did you post that then to the UK for processing?
No. What happens, it was FedEx. DHL to
yeah.
sent via DHL to the courier place, who only about 5 minutes away from here.
So really, as we're speaking, we're still in the middle of this.
Yes, because they're processing. They're actually processing my visa right now.
You're not at the end of your journey then.
No.
And when you've travelled to the UK, hoping that everything runs smoothly moving forward. When you travel to the UK in April 2024, are you planning to settle there, or are you planning to address the documentation situation and return to Trinidad? What are your plans?
Well, I'm of the opinion that I'm a citizen of three countries: the country of my birth, being Saint Lucia; the country where I grew up, which is the UK; and the country where I learned how to become a man, which is Trinidad. So I have allegiances to three countries. I have a residency in Trinidad. I have my place of birth in St. Lucia. So I'll be visiting, right? And I can't turn my back. I have a commitment, say I can't turn my back on Trinidad. But
yeah.
I want to be able to be in the UK and try to reconnect with family, friends, right, loved ones, try to heal some fences which were obviously shattered with my daughter and in the UK.
And where are you planning to live?
Notting Hill.
Yeah. And what about pensions? Because you must have paid tax in the UK, you must be entitled.
Well, the Home Office recognized that, and they've said that they will give me letters to be able to go to the and to get my pension, to get whatever pension. I wouldn't be entitled to a full pension because but at the end of the day, I put that at their doorstep.
Yeah.
If you stop me from coming back, how is that? How can I have made contributions towards a full pension?
So, and this is, I suppose, that's one of the leverage, right, for the compensation. Are you going to accept compensation? What do you think? What do you think? We're not just talking in monetary value, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But what do you think you are owed? What does the British state need to do to rectify and to acknowledge the harm that it has caused you and your family?
First of all, I don't think that the harm done can be repaired either in any way at all, whether it be financially or otherwise. I think you cannot bring back the life you had, so I have to move on. My mother's passed away. There's no way I could be there for her, right? I could pay my respect at the grave. So there's no financial compensation that will do for me, right? You cannot offer me sufficient funds for that, right? What I asked of the British Home Office is to do some serious introspection. You're dealing with human beings. You're dealing with people. There are people all over the Caribbean, all over in Africa, in India, Pakistan, all over, right, that have been ill-treated as a result of this. You need to come speak the truth, right, and let people who have a right to be in the UK be in the UK. It's as simple as that. Yes, I want my compensation. Yes, I should be compensated. But the reality is this, it's bigger than compensation, because people's lives have been turned upside down, right? And I have to consider myself fortunate that I was able to find the wherewithal, the spirituality, to survive. And even now, it affects me, and to a degree my wife as well, because the reality is this, that I've developed, I probably need to see a psychiatrist, to be honest. Kind of harm that I've suffered, right, and anger issues that I have, I need to see somebody. I need to see somebody so I could, you know, basically get rid of the frustration. I mean, I do a lot of things. I hunt. I hunt in Trinidad. And I cannot wait. Hunting season's from October to February, end of February. And every year I find myself, and she'll tell you, I can't wait for hunting season to start. It's something that I love to do, so it just takes away all the negativity, and I'm at peace.
So, we're about to conclude the interview now. Is there anything else that you'd like to share or say before?
I want to thank you for seeing me and giving me an opportunity to go through this, right? And probably somewhere down the line, somebody will see it and try to appreciate what one person went through. There are others who had more dire situations than me. I have to say thank God that I have survived, right? And I continue to try and grow as a person. But one of the things that I will never do, I will never forgive them for this.
Thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.